All right, welcome back to Third String Podcast. Pete and I, after a delay of a few days due to some water damage in my kitchen that I can talk about in just a moment, we're finally coming to you live with a heavily researched segment, right, Pete?
Heavily researched, about as well researched as all of my homework in high school, for anyone who knew me in high school.
Oh, so you did a lot of homework in high school, huh, Pete?
No, not so much.
Not so much.
Not really my thing.
Well, Pete, thank you for accommodating my schedule this week as I had to delay. So you know about our various plumbing issues in this house. We had to call a plumber for the third time. The second time. We called the plumber for the second time because the second leak I fixed. At least yep. I jury-rigged until a plumber could actually fix it. And
this has been the long game for you, right? This has been a couple weeks going on at this point.
Yeah, it's been really bad. Really bad. The first time we had standing water in our basement, carpet and everything. That's never a good thing.
Not great.
Had to call in the drying crew to get everything dried out and all that stuff.
Did they roll up in the cool truck and run the hoses into your house?
They sure did. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
The second time it happened, second time we had a plumbing leak, there was water coming out of a wastewater pipe. And I was able fix that, but turns out the previous homeowner or somebody, whoever did the work previously, didn't do it correctly. I know nothing about plumbing, Pete, so let me just say that up front.
No, water absolutely nothing. Me.
Yeah, no, water and electricity. I don't do those things. But
nope.
So I was able to fix it by, like, I don't even know the terminology for this stuff, but there's a rubber fitting that connects two other pipes. You know, maybe probably some of our listeners know way more about this than I do, but I was able
They're
to kind of
figuring out why neither of us work at Home Depot is
exactly.
What I'm taking away.
I was able to get that into a position where it stopped the leak, but then water started coming out again. And I was like, okay, now I need to call the plumber. And he was like, I have to cut a hole in your drywall to replace this pipe because it was not done correctly. I was like, cool. Just whatever you need to do to fix it. I can do drywall. I've done that before. So
yep.
That's good. So he did that. I'm patching the drywall. And then Sally asks me she asked me if I could check the circuit breaker because our dishwasher's not working. So I was like, oh, sure. Circuit breaker's fine. The dishwasher's just not responding. Called the appliance people, and they're like, oh, yeah, that sounds like the logic board went. And that's very expensive to replace, so you might as well just get a new dishwasher. So
Of course.
Yeah. So we talked it all through, talked to the appliance guys. I got a great appliance guy here in town. If anyone lives in my city, I'm happy to recommend him. But so
I like that you have a guy now.
Now I do. I have to. Because we've also had to replace our dryer since we moved here. Ugh. So this is the second appliance we've bought from this guy. So now I think it's fair to say I have an appliance guy. And I'd walked him through the problem. He was like, yeah, honestly, if I were you, I would just get a new one because you're going to spend a lot of money on this logic board. That might not even be the problem. You could spend all that money on the parts and labor and then it still wouldn't work. Just get a new dishwasher. So that's what we did. And then I was like, I've never installed a dishwasher, but it can't be that hard, right? So he was like, no, it's not really easy.
Famous last words. It can't be that hard.
So actually what happened is I'm proud of myself. I did a good job installing the dishwasher, but the problem came on the uninstall of the old dishwasher because it turns out what happened is near as I can tell in consultation with my appliance guy, his name's Dennis, in consultation with Dennis, it turns out the old dishwasher had been leaking. And it had what's called a catch pan or a floor guard. That's like a little yep. metal pan that sits below the dishwasher to protect your floor. The problem is the electronics also sit precariously close to that floor guard. So when the
that
floor guard,
sound like great planning,
terrible planning. So when the floor guard filled up with water, it submerged at least some of the electronic pieces.
Oh,
and
no.
As far as I can tell, basically shorted and fried the logic board. So that's what happened there. So that's like you say, problem solved, right? New dishwasher, fry control board. Well, not quite, because it turns out that leak had been ongoing for a long time.
Oh,
and just earlier that day, in fact, my daughter was in the basement. It was like, why does it smell so bad in the basement? And I was no. I don't know, but that's not a good sign. So then I ripped up our whole kitchen floor. That's still ripped up. And I'm having to do a lot of repair. It's really fun.
Are you having to sit on YouTube as you're doing all these repairs? Because that's
100%.
No matter what job I'm doing, I just sit on YouTube and they make it look so easy, and it is never that easy.
100%.
So most important question for you is Dennis a friend of Third String, And can your appliance guy start sponsoring the pod? Because I think that that's the next logical step. You've bought a lot of appliances from you. It's clear that we're in this together with Dennis at this point.
It's a good question. You know, next time I have an appliance breakdown and I visit Dennis in his shop, I'll ask him. I'll ask him if he's like willing to be a DFOP, a dear friend of the pod, and sponsor us.
Ooh, DFOP. I haven't heard that one.
Yeah.
Ask him if he's got a guy in Vegas, because do you know I have a natural gas dryer? Have you ever heard of that? We use natural gas for our dryer out
That's
here.
A it thing.
Is ridiculous.
Is that safe?
Nope, not even a little. Okay. Especially when you walk in the laundry room and you smell gas that one time and have to call the gas company we did about a month and a half after we moved into this house.
Nice,
so,
good.
Yeah, not a fan.
Natural gas. Now, I've heard of gas ovens. I mean, sometimes when we turn on our ovens, like it smells like gas just for a minute or two when it heats up.
Yeah.
But natural gas dryer, wow.
I'm just wondering if it's because utilities are so expensive out here because they're moving air conditioners and all these coolants are working so hard that they're trying to find ways to take pressure off the grid. I don't know. I'm just guessing here. But yeah, I have a gas stove, which I never had. I've always grown up with electric stoves.
I love gas stoves,
I've got
man.
A gas stove. I've got a gas dryer, which is interesting. I mean, it's a little better for my utility bills in theory, but then my question is, I can't move that dryer once I leave here because there's no other place in America that uses that. So congratulations to whoever moves in here. After we move out, you get a free gas dryer that has a couple pen marks, and I accidentally put a marker through the wash a couple weeks ago.
Did
so
you have to buy
that.
It?
No, it came with the house because much like you, our previous residents were also some of the presents they left us.
Nice.
Do you know how hard it is to get rid of a refrigerator? That was actually my conquest for this week. I had a little mini fridge that was left by the previous residents.
Yeah.
I decided, you know, this is an old fridge. Like the door didn't even seal properly. So right. It froze half the stuff in there,
yep.
Which on a beer fridge is aggressive. Let me tell you.
It is.
Do you know how much you have to pay to get rid of a refrigerator with all that coolant? I ended up having to go to a junkyard and I basically sold it to them, but it was going to take them 45 minutes to write me a check for $350. So I left it. And now someone gets a free refrigerator.
Oh,
but long
like
story short, $3
previous and 50
owners,
cents?
Terrible. Yes.
Oh, you said, I was like, you left $350 on the table? But in retrospect, that would be a lot of money for a mini fridge.
$350.
Yeah.
So
boy, I would have done
who
the same
knew
thing.
That we were starting an appliance pod? This is exciting for this us. Third is some, string brand is growing right in front of our ears.
Some real riveting banter here at the beginning. And
have we lost all 9 listeners in the last 10 minutes?
Probably have. It's interesting, though, because we decided to have all this riveting banter on a day where there is a ton to talk about in the world of sports, Pete.
It has been a crazy week. We talked about recording on Sunday, and then obviously you had the great flood over there with your ARC. We had the football playoffs. Monday morning, news broke about Major League Baseball, and we started to see the punishments come down towards the Astros. Tuesday, it hit the Red Sox. Wednesday, we start seeing all this crazy stuff about Odell Beckham Jr. on the sidelines of the college football playoff and all that crazy stuff. Today, the Mets are affected. We've got all sorts of allegations. It has been a crazy week. We have talked every day about jumping on the pod, and every day there's just more to talk about. So we got to hit this head on, my man.
I love it. Let's start with small ball. There's some things we want to talk about that are, we could say, relatively minor compared to the big news of the week. But I think the plan for today, Pete, we should do some small ball, talk about some smaller sports stories. Our hot take segment, I think we've got some hot takes on the baseball scandal. We'll just call it the great baseball scandal of 2020, because there's just so many layers of this that keep coming out day after day. At this point, I'm glad, Pete, that we did not record on Sunday night because the Astros stuff broke Monday. But then literally every day since then, there's been new stories and allegations against new players and personnel and management. And it's really exciting, kind of a dark week for baseball, but an exciting time to be alive. What a time, Pete.
What a time.
And then in our pick'em segment, we'll talk about AFC and NFC championships. Sound good?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what there really isn't any more we could possibly cram into this hour-long pod if we tried. So let's get after it with some small ball.
Sounds great. I'll start off with my first small ball topic, and that is Luke Kuechly of the Carolina Panthers retiring at 28. Luke Kuechly is almost exactly my age, retiring from a sport to which he has devoted his entire adult life. And I have to say, I applaud him for it. This is a guy who has played middle linebacker, probably, for my money, the most punishing position on a football field. Slot receiver is pretty bad as well because you're often like taking the blind hits and whatnot. But middle linebacker, yeah, you're just in what they used to call the pit, like that the middle part of the field that's super dangerous all the time, every play, taking guys down hard. And Kuechly's not a huge guy. I think he's maybe an inch taller than me. Certainly a lot stronger and heavier than me, but he's not a huge guy by NFL standards. Middle linebackers are guys who are taking on defensive ends or offensive tackles rather routinely, right? They're taking on these like 300-pound yep. guys on the line and having to beat them. And that just, it's going to wear your body down a lot. On top of that, Luke Kuechly's had a couple diagnosed concussions, including that one, I think it was 2 years ago now, Pete, where he was crying on the field. It was just disturbing to watch that. Was that last year or two seasons ago?
I think it was 2 years ago, and it affected him last year as well. Was that as they were making the early playoff run, and we really thought that they were poised after they were playing in the Super Bowl 2 years before that they would be back? And I think the Panthers kind of fizzled out with that. And the end of Ron Rivera, the end of Cam Newton, the end of Luke Kuechly, probably the end of Greg Olsen. Yeah. I mean, that you can't all pit it on that one injury that Luke took, but the chemistry of that team just started to break down so quickly as he got hurt and the injuries mounted for that franchise. So, yeah, I think you're right. That was kind of a watershed moment.
And this is it's not a hot take at all, because I think I've seen nothing but support for Kuechly making the decision that he feels like he had to make at this age. But it is a reminder of the dangers in football. And I don't want this to turn into a long conversation about whether or not you should feel conflicted about watching football. But I do feel conflicted about it every day, because these guys are taking and giving punishing hits. And in 25 or 30-year-old bodies, that doesn't feel like much. But as time goes on, it will feel like a lot. And it'll probably rob at least some of them of time with, kids and grandkids. And hopefully, they'll live to have great grandkids and all of that. But it is sad. I'm glad that Kuechly made the decision he made. I think he's certainly one of the best defenders that we've been able to watch over the past decade. Yeah. Just in a class all his own as a linebacker, I think. But he's also, he's also not super unique in the fact that people of his position or of similar positions have retired at pretty young ages. Navarro Bowman, who had, I think, kind of like knee problems, ACL problems. But Chris Borland made a similar decision, probably 5-6 years ago now. It was a while ago.
Cam Chancellor 2 years ago out of the Seahawks.
Yep, exactly. And then, of course, Calvin Johnson. I mean, he's an offensive player, a little bit different. Andrew Luck, also a little bit different. But we are seeing this be more common.
That's the one I was going to bring up to you is if you're the NFL, and we've talked a lot about Roger Goodell is just constantly working a growing PR problem with the more we learn about the injuries that are being suffered at every level of football at this point, and the confliction that's going on with parents around the world right now with how they handle that. You have to wonder, what is the NFL thinking that they keep losing these 20-something stars who are, I mean, not necessarily the franchise players. I mean, you could argue that with Andrew Luck, but a lot of the defenders we rattled off have been so critical towards playoff runs, who become the faces of their franchises. I mean, you see them on all the NFL commercials, you see them on all the United Way commercials, and you're seeing these guys step back and step back. You wonder, is football thinking that we're just going to have to deal with a younger playing core at this point, where it's going to be younger players because no one can really hang around past the age of 30, save for your Marshawn Lynch's of the world and then quarterbacks who've had a good offensive line? It's very interesting watching kind of the evolution of players and how we're seeing so many more step back so much quicker, that I'm sure that this has gone on forever, that players have medically retired. But the level in terms of kind of the elite top tier status that we're seeing Kuechly retire it's shocking. I mean, you think about what happened in Indianapolis when Andrew Luck stepped back. You think about what's going on in Carolina with all of the things going on in Carolina right now. You wonder if maybe that was a factor, that for Luke Kuechly, it was, why am I going to continue putting myself in harm's way for a team that is in a rebuild right now? And I'm not having a lot of fun playing and it's beating me up and I'm losing time with my kids. And you just don't know. If you're the NFL, I don't know how you solve this problem. You hate the targeting call and how much it's changing the sport, but at the same time, these guys can't continue to deal with these kind of hits if we expect them to be productive members of society and functioning here for the next 20, 25 years.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think it's interesting, the predominant commentary around Kuechly has been that this is, you know, exhibit A for concussion risks and all of that. I think to a large extent, that is absolutely correct. And it's scary to think that every player in the NFL is effectively one concussion away from their career being over, right?
And absolutely.
And
you could even argue just one injury away sure. at this point.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely that. I mean, especially an injury with a long rehab period. I mean, there's a never-ending list of players who go down with an Achilles tear or an ACL tear, and those injuries are so hard to come back from. You know, you play in a position like wide receiver, you lose a step and you're falling from top 10 in the league to, you know, bottom 10 in the league, and the team might not sign you. So the margin for error is so small, and concussions do that for a couple of reasons. One is, I mean, they can affect your cognitive function, your ability to kind of process what's happening on the field. And I think that happened with Kuechly a little bit, and I think he realized that. He just hasn't been quite the same player as he was in like 2015. I think 2016 was his first really bad concussion. He got another one in 2017. But ultimately, I mean, I wouldn't say that he has been bad at all. He's still been one of the best linebackers in the game for the past two seasons. But I think there's a slight and subtle, but noticeable drop off in his performance since then. And I think he knows that too, and just thinks to himself, why am I going to keep playing this punishing position here? But the crazy thing is, you're right. I mean, the NFL does need to get on top of this stuff. I'm biased as an Eagles fan, but I did watch Carson Wentz take that hit from Jadeveon Clowney. Also watched Lamar Jackson take a hit to the head that was unnecessary while he was diving forward and giving himself up. And that kind of stuff. I mean, it's scary to think that Carson Wentz or Lamar Jackson's career could have ended or been effectively ended right there on that play. And to be honest, maybe it was. I mean, we don't know if Carson Wentz is going to come back and be the same quarterback he was.
Sure.
It's possible that he won't. I mean, I hope he will. I think it's probable that he will be the same quarterback he was, but maybe he'll never be the same quarterback. And we'll look back on a play like that thinking that's what made the difference.
Yeah, think about all the ways that Peyton Manning's mobility with that neck injury, where he was one big hit away from potentially being paralyzed, how much that had to change. I mean, he was never the most mobile quarterback in the world, but you think of some of these guys who have been so good for so long and how much they've had to change their playing style out of fear that one big hit is coming. If I'm the NFL and I'm the NFLPA right now, I'm probably going to start looking into how do we expand our rosters past kind of the 53-man, open that up. There's so many players, it seems like, the past two or three years on the injured reserve that you wonder how long before NFL owners accept that they're going to have to pay more people in order to keep these teams competitive. I mean, injuries, I swear we've talked about it all 3 years we've been doing this podcast, that every year injuries just decimate the league, and that's just the nature of the business at this point. The NFLPA, I think, needs to get those rosters expanded to try to keep these teams competitive and make sure the guys aren't necessarily rushing back from injuries just to try to hold their roster spot. Obviously, that will always be going on, but maybe it's time to expand those rosters and bring some more guys off the practice squad to make sure that we have enough able bodies that guys can truly heal up before they get back on the field.
My solution is to have every player wear those giant inflatable balls that you run around on fields with and can roll around in and stuff.
The bubble.
Yeah, the bubble, whatever you call that. I have to think of a solution for how you can catch a ball through the bubble, but I mean, the NFL makes billions of dollars a year. They've got to be able to solve a solution for that.
I thought you were going to say the Wes Welker giant helmet scheme that he was wearing in Denver there those last few years, where that helmet was at least four sizes too large for his head. I mean, did it just have
extra padding? Because he had a concussion history as well. Did it just have a ton of extra padding built in there? What do you think?
That's what I assumed, is so he wouldn't, his brain wouldn't slosh around as much as it was. And I mean, he was a slot guy, right? He was a slot guy from start to finish. He was always over the middle, just getting crushed.
It's awful. It's terrible. You know, I mean, this is the last thing I'll say on this topic, and then I want to hear one of your small ball topics, but I was on Twitter the other day and I saw somebody, because Antonio Brown got in trouble again, right? For, I don't know, I only skimmed the story, but something about provoking police or something in California, or I don't know. But Antonio Brown is making a fool of himself again. And his agent cut ties with him, said he wants to work with him, but he won't until Antonio Brown seeks help. I mean, Antonio Brown is, he's kind of fallen off the wagon here, and it's sad to see, especially because this tweet that I saw was saying, every time I see Antonio Brown in the news again for something like this, I just think of this. And it was the clip of Vontaze Burfict coming across the middle and just delivering the most punishing, crushing blow to the head I've ever seen on a sports field anywhere.
Yep.
And Antonio Brown like flying around and flopping down to the ground, totally ragdoll because he's totally knocked out.
And he's never been the same.
Never been the same. And I think about that every time Brown does something stupid as well. Like this guy legit has brain damage and that's horrifying.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're probably preaching to the choir or at least saying things that people already know, but I think it's good to reflect on. I hope that for the sake of the game and the players in it, I hope we can figure out good ways of protecting these brains. But what do you have for small ball, Pete?
Well, it's funny. We'll kind of stick with the big NFL receivers doing really, really interesting things. Odell Beckham Jr., a proud alumnus of Louisiana State University, winning the college football playoff this week. It's so fascinating to watch. This sounds vicious. It's not meant to be, but the demise of his public reputation in front of us when we thought it was rebuilding by going back to Cleveland, that it seems like the New York Giants and the Pittsburgh Steelers with Antonio Brown and Odell Beckham Jr. had ways not to control their players, but to make sure that they had, I don't know, maybe a team watching these guys or at least helping control their public image. But you look at OBJ when he went to Cleveland and what he even did this week where he is on the field handing out cash to players in front of the cameras, going into the locker room, good gaming a cop. Now there's an arrest out, or I'm sorry, there's a warrant out for his arrest for simple battery against that police officer. And you watch that what should have been a huge day for LSU and was in every right. It still was, but has been tainted by one of their proud alums who was just doing stupid things again, just on what was the biggest stage. Like he couldn't let it be about the players. There are three or four other clips that have surfaced here in the past couple of days about him grabbing the megaphone in front of the marching band, not giving it back, doing weird things on the sidelines around cheerleaders. And you're just looking at it. And again, if you're the NFL and going back to your point, talking about CTE, you're looking at these superstars and you're looking at their inability to function in society right now on these big stages. And you just have to wonder what are we going to do to make sure that we keep not only the respectability of the game, but we truly take care of these guys, because it's clear Antonio Brown is not the same. I would argue it's clear that Odell Beckham Jr. is going off the reservation.
Yeah.
You look at the things he said as the situation in Cleveland has deteriorated. I don't know if it's substance. I don't know if it's exhaustion. I don't know if it's blows to the head. But it's clear that a lot of these big-time receivers are burning out so quickly in front of us that, again, if you're the NFL, you have to wonder. So I'm having my stars who are genuinely regarded as kind of the good dudes, the United Way, out in front, like the Luke Kuechlys, the Andrew Lucks, walking away from the sport. And then you have the guys who are showing up on Sunday night and Monday Night Football and doing phenomenal things, making fantasy owners so happy, who can't even watch their college team win the national championship without destroying some aspect of it. I mean, I don't think the NCAA would hand down some kind of a sanction to LSU just based on all of the dynamics of that situation. But he put that entire program in a precarious place within the course of an hour and a half, just with everything he did. So that was just my interesting take this week is how much some of these guys who we have celebrated for so long but probably haven't taken care of are detracting from not only the game, but just an ability to function in society so quickly.
Well, let's stay on the LSU game because I wanted to bring up Joe Burrow. I was not a believer even a month and a half ago, Pete. I just think, you know, he had some good performances against some good SEC teams, but also, you know, the typical SEC schedule, you're going to have those stat padding games in there and all of that.
Sure.
But the way that he just completely dismantled teams in the college football playoff. Incredible. And the throws he's making to the receivers that he had on that team. I think this guy is the real deal. And that's a small assessment or a big assessment based on a small sample size. But I have to say he won me over big time. If I'm a Cincinnati Bengals fan, I am excited.
Yeah, I agree. if I am another team like the Panthers, who have just pulled the LSU passing game coordinator from LSU to go be my offensive coordinator, I have to imagine there are 25 teams right now trying to figure out what the Bengals threshold is for that first overall pick. I think the Bengals need it. I think he's the kind of guy you can build around. I really do. But at the same time, like, that raw talent that we saw this year, and I was like you, I knew LSU was good the first half of the season, but it wasn't until the second half of the season. Specifically for me, what stands out is the LSU-Alabama game. Watching just that incredible performance where, what was that final score? 51-45 something. Like, I mean, it was just, it was a shootout, which the SEC is known for explosive offense, but pretty darn good defense as well. And they just, they dismantled it.
46-41, 87 combined points scored.
Yeah, it was just, it was incredible. And I think you, I remember seeing the way Joe Burrow did it.
I think the over-under for that game was something like 44. So like the, or 40 or something like that. I think that both teams exceeded the over-under single-handedly.
Yeah. It was something. And you listen to Joe Burrow's story, and I mean, how he was a grad transfer, but a transfer from Ohio State, right. Wasn't completely content with how that was working out at Ohio State, sat out a year. And then you look at his Heisman speech, where it's not all about, you all counted me out, you counted my family out. It was very much focused on community and building that team. And it was refreshing to hear. I'm absolutely rooting for him. There's some hilarious memes comparing both he and Trevor Lawrence to Macaulay Culkin and all these guys. I'll send you some of these. They're fantastic. But I'm absolutely rooting for Joe Burrow.
I love it. Yeah, I think one I saw was comparing Joe Burrow to Macaulay Culkin and Trevor Lawrence to Ronnie Sunshine Bass. And Titans.
Exactly.
Pretty good.
Exactly. I'm going to send you one. It's a meme of Macaulay Culkin in Home Alone when he's all happy. And then it says, after 3 years with the Bengals, and it's a picture of Macaulay Culkin now smoking.
I saw a stat that I think was from Adam Schefter, who said that Joe Burrow has had 63 touchdowns this season. Of course, he set the FBS record for most touchdowns thrown. And then he said that Andy Dalton has 66 total touchdowns over the last three seasons. Zing.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be much of a QB competition unless for some reason that young Bengals coaching staff decides that they want him to learn an NFL offense without taking hits, and they want him to be on the sideline for the first four or six games. But I don't think that's the way the NFL is working right now. I don't think a fan base is going to tolerate that. Agreed. I don't think an ownership with the first overall pick is going to tolerate him standing on the sideline.
Yeah,
so
I agree.
It'll be interesting.
Yeah, totally. All right. Anything else for small ball?
No. Let's get into the main event here.
So I do want to actually real quick. I do have one more thing for small ball. Justin Fuente staying at Virginia Tech. You mentioned the Carolina Panthers and their new coach, Matt Rhule. He left Baylor. Fuente interviewed for the Baylor job, announced just today. You were texting me last night, distraught, saying that you were going to lose Fuente to Baylor. And then he announced this morning that he's staying. So what are your 30-second thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, first of all, apologies to both you and my dad, who took a flurry of text messages about my dark times.
I did tell you I thought he was going to stay at Virginia Tech. I just don't see I don't see Baylor as an inherently more attractive position than Blacksburg.
See, here's where I think that's different. I think a lot of us, like you and I, who have been college football fans for a long time, still think of the heyday of a lot of these, specifically ACC and Big Ten schools,
sure,
as well as I think you could argue the Pac-12. But in reality, Virginia Tech hasn't been good since, I would argue, 2010, 2011. I mean, they're always going to compete, hopefully make a bowl game. But you look, Baylor has had top 15 finishes five of the last 10 years. The money coming from Texas is just incredible. But I think the pressure of coaching in Texas is very, very high as well. Yep. And I think that that has to wear on you.
I mean, you know, he's coming into Virginia Tech, and like you said, it's a program that has been down for a while. So if you come into the program at the very lowest point, you can go nowhere but up, right? If you come into the program at Baylor, where Matt Rhule has just executed a remarkable 2-year turnaround, then, you know, and you came this close to the college football playoff and even closer to the Big 12 championship, I mean, you're probably going to see some regression your first year, and you don't want that. That's going to make it very stressful for you, and the pressure is going to be on real quick.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think it's It's just, it's an interesting statement on collegiate athletics right now, where the only game in town in the ACC is Clemson. And you look at the money they've put into facilities, and you look at the alumni dollars. And like you and I talked about when we really talked about the BCS versus the new college football playoff system, the parity in college football is gone. So I think if you're an offensive guy, you're looking at the Big 12. You're looking at the Big 10 because there's not as much defense. A lot more defense in the Big 10 than the Big 12. But you think of those as your big, heavy offensive passing leagues where you've got a lot of young recruits coming out of the state of Texas and the state of Oklahoma. You got a lot of money. You got a lot of alumni influence. I mean, you think about A&M when they brought in Jimbo Fisher. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's an SEC school. But the culture is just so different in those that I think if you can handle the pressure, I actually think the ceiling is a little higher and the floor is lower, if that makes sense. Like,
yeah,
I think
for
that
sure.
At Baylor, I think they would have accepted once Matt Rhule left that they were going to be down for a little while. I think what Fuente's issue was is he came in and the expectations were too high after that first year. And you see that a lot with coaches where they come in, they've got the instant chemistry, they're the new guy on the block, so everything is exciting and new, and the fans are willing to give him a chance, and they set this high bar. And if that team can't get up to that level and perform year in and year out, it's that coach has lost a step, and you start nitpicking everything.
Right.
What was interesting about Fuente is he is nationally known for being a terrible communicator. He loves his guys love him, but he doesn't really seem to like engaging with the fan base or the alumni base, which I get. It's exhausting. Expectations are high, but you look at the way that he handled this and just kind of sneaking out to go talk to Baylor, and then he never actually announced that he was staying after all these rumors surfaced. He put out a tweet early this morning that just said, let's go. And it was a picture of him in a staff meeting. And it's one of those, again, like Justin, like just get in front of the microphone and say, I'm happy to be here. I wanted to be here. And it's one of those. And you just hear these fan bases around the country just screaming for their coach. I get it. Like, it is his life. He is in it so much more than I will ever be as a fan. But sometimes it would be nice if he reminded me that he is just as committed to this program as I am. And that's what every college fan wants, is for their coach to be as committed. It's just hard for us to remember it's a business. And I think we look at the LSUs, we look at all these SEC schools and how they're producing. They treat it like a business.
Right.
And Ed Orgeron is the most loyal guy to the state of Louisiana in the world, but he was also the USC coach 2 years ago. He wanted to be the USC coach when he was the interim, and they wouldn't let him stay and be the interim. So you want to talk about program loyalty? It's there when that program is performing at top level. But these guys, they're living and breathing this 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They got to make the right decisions financially as well as like future growth.
Yeah, for sure. That's a good point. All right, you ready for a hot take?
Please.
All right. Do you have a hot take you want to articulate in this this great baseball scandal of 2020 segment here?
So I think my hot take was a lot hotter on Monday, and now it's not as fun. Looking at the penalties that Major League Baseball imposed on the Astros due to the sign stealing gate. I don't know. Have we assigned a gate to this yet?
Like, no, I don't think so.
We'll have to do that. We've got some candidates.
We could have... we could call it Cora Gate since he's the ringleader.
What about Trash Can Gate?
I was going to say Trash Can Gate. Yeah, I kind of like that one.
Buzzer Gate, now that we've heard about Altuve wearing a buzzer.
That's right. Astrogate.
Ooh, Astrogate's good.
Yeah.
You know, I like that Astrogate.
All right, Astrogate.
Yeah,
let's
stick with that one.
Okay.
I'm kind of partial to Trash Can Gate because it's hilarious.
I know.
But I think Astrogate's better.
Astrogate rolls off the tongue a little bit better.
Yeah. But looking at the penalties they handed down on Monday, with giving the year-long suspensions to A.J. Hinch as well as the GM of the Astros, and the Astros subsequently firing them. You and I were texting about this immediately. I wanted Major League Baseball to take the trophy, the hardware, take down the banner, remove it. I understand that this is a slippery, slippery slope to ever undo something that is in the past, because you can't. I mean, what do you do? If you,
take,
say
you
that
take
they
away Barry Bonds home runs, right? I mean,
yeah,
that's the same path.
And I want them to take back the bonuses that players made for winning the World Series. You got to pay those back. I want them to physically remove the trophy, and I want them to take the banner down at Minute Maid Park. I don't want them to vacate all 107 wins or however many they had in 2017. I don't want them to go back and retroactively say the Dodgers won the World Series. I don't want us to change the past. I just want us to erase the things that have been clearly and definitively identified as a cohesive effort to deceive and cheat to win the World Series. So it's, we can compare this to so many other incidents of possible cheating. I mean, Pete Rose kind of comes to mind with betting on baseball and that individual. And I understand why he got the lifetime ban. I don't think that's aged as well. That's another topic. But you look at the Astros, this was a cohesive effort across multiple people with many players roped in. It was well known throughout the sport, we have learned in 2017, that the Astros were actively stealing signs. And you have to send the message that you don't just punish the guy who is in charge. Yes, he absolutely deserves to be punished, and he has accepted a lot of the blame and a lot of the fault. But what message are we sending to the players? When you take PEDs, which, by the way, don't necessarily speed up reaction time, they don't make it easier to identify a curveball. When you do that, we ban you for 80 games. When you cheat like this and win the World Series, we fire your manager and look the other way that you're doing it. What message are we trying to send here? So I don't think that's as hot now. I think now that this has simmered for a few more days and we've learned more and more and people are getting angrier and angrier, I think more people are in my camp than were on Monday. But just because the precedent wasn't there for Major League Baseball doesn't mean that they couldn't do this. They had to send a message. I would argue this is the most catastrophic thing to happen to baseball since Shoeless Joe, to be completely honest, that I think this is worse than the Barry Bonds, Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa, PEDs scandal. I really do. Those were individuals doing things. This was a team who ultimately won the World Series because of their cheating.
Yeah, I think I have a nuanced disagreement there with you. I don't think that this is... I'd have to think about that a little bit. I don't, my instinct is to say this is not as bad as Barry Bonds, Sosa, McGwire, Alex Rodriguez, everyone else shooting up with steroids, because that, I think that was just as systematic and widespread. Like, yes, it was individuals who were shooting up, but it was systematic in that, you know, everyone was doing it. And if you read like the Mitchell report, you know, you'll see stories of guys who were definitely enabling each other and distributing this stuff and all that. So it was just as widespread. It was also like, you know, there's a disregard for your own health, you know, kind of an offense against human dignity with respect to that as well, where you're shooting up, you know, substances with known and unknown effects into your body to try to get an edge.
Sure.
So that's what I would say on that. On the sign stealing thing, I mean, there's nothing wrong with sign stealing per se, right? It's you know, figuring out how pitchers tip pitches. If you're a runner on second base, and you have a system for trying to figure out what signal the catcher is sending, and then you relay that to your own team's batter who's at the plate. None of that has ever been illegal. That's always been a part of the game. Obviously, what's different here is, like you said, the systematized practice of the Houston Astros in using video replay equipment from center field, from a center field camera, to identify what the catcher's doing. So basically, you know, regardless of whether or not there's a runner on second base, regardless of what you can pick up from a pitcher who is or is not tipping his pitches, the Astros had a system in place to use technology, which in itself was prohibited by Major League Baseball for, you know, on-field in-game assistance, to identify what a catcher was doing, correlate it with what a pitcher is throwing, and then signal to the batter what pitch was coming so they could expect, you know what to expect. It's really bad. I mean, there's no way around that. The unfortunate thing is it took a part of the game that is strategic and kind of tactical but underappreciated, and that is like the art of sign stealing. And instead just kind of bastardized it and brute forced it, and it's just kind of dumb. I mean, even the trash can, like the trash can's funny because they're pounding on a trash can, and someone thought that was, I mean, I guess they were right. They thought it was like a good idea for a covert signal, and it took a while for anyone to pick up on it. But like, they're banging a trash can, you know. They took this like wonderful hidden piece of the game, you know, the art of sign stealing or pitch tipping, and just turned it into this like ridiculous covert, but also kind of grotesque and brute translation system. Anyway, this is a long thing to say. I think I slightly disagree with you that this is worse than the steroid era, but this is almost as bad. I think my hot take, so I disagree with you about the vacating of the trophy only because trophies are not just to a team, they're also for a city, you know? And I just think about like fans, you know, championships mean a lot to fans, you know? And the Astros won the World Series the same sports cycle that the Eagles won the Super Bowl. And, you know, the Eagles Super Bowl win meant a lot to me. And it would be awful to find out that it was somehow tainted because, I don't know, the Eagles had, like, you know, a film crew at Patriots practice, right? And sort of knew the playbook ahead of time. That'd be probably the most analogous situation. And that'd be awful, and it would already feel kind of tainted and would like sting for me a little bit just to know that it wasn't like a totally fairly earned Super Bowl. But it would really be crushing for me to no longer be able to say that like the Eagles won the Super Bowl, you know? And so for the sake of the fans, I think vacating would be a little bit harsh. I do totally agree with you. Take the bonuses away from the players. I also agree with you that these players need to be suspended. I mean, I take your point. Like, we suspend, you know, how many times a year do we see so-and-so suspended 80 games for a violation of the...
Yeah, it feels like half the relief pitchers of Major League Baseball are getting suspended for 80 games.
Exactly. And here we have, you know, the entire Houston Astros team is at the very least aware, right? But for most of them, actively participating in this scheme. And
I mean, Altuve won the batting title in 2017, and he was wearing a buzzer.
Yeah, and we're going to do nothing about it. Nothing. So I totally agree with you. I mean, I do think that as this information comes out more, I think we will see suspensions, honestly. I think, especially if the buzzer stuff. So just a quick background for our listeners on the buzzer stuff. This just broke, I think, earlier today. That's the first time I saw it.
Yeah, within the last couple hours. Yeah.
But the reports are that Bregman and Altuve were wearing, in addition to being able to pick up on the trash can, they were wearing buzzers that would relay some kind of information to them. Maybe it was just a binary, like, you know, buzz means curveball, no buzz fastball or whatever, but it might've been more complicated than that too. I mean, like three buzzes, a slider, right? Two buzzes, whatever. So that's the latest report. Of course, Bregman was good 2 years ago, was absolutely incredible last year. Unclear if this system could have been in place last year too, but I've loved Altuve. He's been one of my favorite players in the game for a long time.
Same.
To me, his reputation has taken a huge hit. Forget about the buzzer. Just the fact that he was, you know, he was in the know on this scheme, taking a huge hit for me. I used to like the Astros as of, you know, earlier this week, really after, you know, news of this first broke a month and a half ago or so. I'm really no longer a fan of the Astros. I read Astro Ball by Ben Ryder last year.
I remember you were really big on that book.
Great book. Yeah. It was really, I mean, I still recommend the book. It was good, but it taints the whole thing. It's a bummer. But my hot take, what I was going to say, Pete, is that I actually think, so to my knowledge, there's one person who's ever had a lifetime ban from Major League Baseball. I could be wrong on that. But to my knowledge, it's Pete Rose.
I thought a lot of the...
like the early guys?
The Shoeless Joe guys.
Yeah, okay. I think Shoeless Joe, that's true. I guess that's a good point. Can we call it the modern era, though, like 1960 forward? I don't know. Let me do a quick Google search for permanent suspensions.
I'll give you that.
Let me do permanent suspensions in baseball and see what comes up. But Pete Rose, of course, was suspended lifetime for gambling in baseball, and the gambling
as the manager of the Reds. I mean, so he was affecting play on the field,
right? So here's the thing, though. My hot take is that what the Astros did is way worse than what Pete Rose did as manager of the Reds.
100% agree.
Okay.
100% agree.
And I would say, I mean, honestly, I would go further, and this is a different conversation probably, but I would go further. By the way, there's a lot of banned people from baseball. Holy smokes. Yeah, Commissioner Landis just went ham on these people and just banned them left and right. Whoa. But yeah, you're right. The Chicago White Sox crew conspiring to throw the 1919 World Series. I mean, that'll do it, right? That's pretty flagrant.
Yeah, not great.
But yeah, there are a number of people, so I completely take back my claim of that. However, Pete Rose was the only person banned under Commissioner Bart Giamatti. And let's see.
He's probably the last one who's been banned for life in the modern era, right? I mean,
let's see. George Steinbrenner and Steve Howe were both
early 90s.
Yeah, George Steinbrenner, Steve Howe were both briefly banned, but had their bans lifted. Marge Schott was banned in 96 for being a racist. I'm giving comments. It's not clear if she was ever
get some more people for that one.
Not clear if she was ever unbanned. And then there were some who were banned for various PED stuff, you know, third time offenses. Oh, yeah, John Coppolella. I forgot about him. He was GM of the Braves. He was banned for circumventing the international signings rules. I didn't realize Brandon Taubman was added to the banned list. He can apply for reinstatement after the 2020 World Series. Also, Chris Correa, who went to jail for hacking the Astros, he was also banned. Yep. So there are a number of people. Anyway, one of the interesting things, though, is in this report, Pete, the Astros, or the MLB commissioner's report, Manfred's report, cites this very toxic baseball operations culture. And we're seeing that come to fruition here.
And it's the win-at-all-cost culture.
Exactly. I mean, when I read Astro Ball last year, what I was struck by was the fact that the Astros were such a forward-thinking, next-gen, analytics-first-focused clubhouse and baseball ops department. That's probably all true. I mean, it seems backed up by fact. But what's also true is that they make decisions with win-at-all-costs front and center. And that includes, you know, signing Roberto Ozuna. It obviously includes actively condoning, or at the very least turning a blind eye toward, cheating. And that's really sad, because there are some guys on the Astros that I really love rooting for. Carlos Correa was one. I already mentioned Jose Altuve. George Springer. Alex Bregman. Carlos Beltran. I mean, the Beltran run at the end there, and burying the glove in the outfield and all that stuff. I mean, that was fun, and it was a fun team to root for. And
think about what happened in Houston in the fall of 2017. Was they had the hurricane,
right?
You had JJ Watt doing all this stuff with the Texans, and then joining up with the Astros. The city of Houston needed that championship so badly.
Are you saying it shouldn't be vacated, Pete?
No, I'm not. I'm not. I know it hurts the fans, and I know it's not the fans' fault, but at the same time, how can you continue flying that banner in that stadium knowing what we know now? I mean, almost if anything, you're a fan. I mean, it'll hurt to look up and know where that banner was for the next couple of years and not see it. But at the same time, you're going to be talking about that banner forever if it continues to fly. You can't move on with that huge asterisk for the Astros sitting out there in center. You have to put an end to this now. You just have to move on, rip the Band-Aid off, and press.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Maybe the requirement should just be they have to, everywhere they claim the World Series or the World Series title appears, you have to put an asterisk next to it.
I like it. I like it. I like it. If anything, that's more hurtful.
A giant asterisk on the World Series banner in the stadium.
Think of the money that would cost them. I like it.
It'd be hilarious.
Maybe that's where all those bonuses from the World Series could go to, is paying for that.
On the Pete Rose thing real quick, where I was going with Pete Rose was, you know, it's gambling on games that you're involved in, not ideal. Gambling against teams that you have the ability to help win, I think is really bad, right? Because, and that's basically what Shoeless Joe and the rest of them were doing, right? But I mean, like, Pete Rose is gambling on games. And the Dowd Report, which established all the gambling that Pete Rose did, the Dowd Report has a line in there that says there's no evidence that he ever bet against the Reds. If he bet against the Reds, I would say that's bad.
He bet for the Reds when he was managing
them. So betting for the Reds while you're managing them. I mean, to me, like, so it broke rules. Major League Baseball has rules against doing that. You can't bet on any game that you're involved in. So I get that. He broke rules. He should have been disciplined for that, et cetera. But how is, like, functionally speaking, you know, players gamble on their performance all the time, right? And, you know, defer a contract year or accept a 1-year deal, et cetera, betting on themselves. And people even use that phrase. I mean, he's betting on himself, right? Betting on themselves that they can do really well and get a payday later down the road, right? And I don't see this as, like, metaphysically different, I guess, from Pete Rose being like, I'm going to bet $1,000 that I'm going to lead my team to victory tonight, you know? So in that sense, like, it's not that bad. Now, there are other, like, extenuating circumstances. I mean, like, Pete Rose's total lack of contrition, his total denial of all those things, like, all those compound the discipline, and I get it, and I understand it. I don't think it's totally unreasonable that he was banned for life. I also think he kind of, you know, didn't get along with Bart Giamatti and all of that stuff. He didn't make things easier for himself and all of that. But just going back to a fundamental level, what he did, nowhere near as bad as what the Astros did.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I think my only concern with betting with some kind of bookie or something like that is it just opens you up to so much blackmail and so many opportunities to be swayed. And you look at what happened with, I can't remember the name of the NBA ref. Was that Jeff Donahue? Is that who that was? So. Or the Boston College scandal in the late 80s where those guys were point shaving. It opens you up to so much. But If we had figured out that Pete Rose was betting the over-under, if he was betting against his team, if he was making prop bets, I think that is more serious than betting for your team. But I understand why Major League Baseball did it. I just think it's time, based on how Major League Baseball has trended, it's time to overturn the Pete Rose thing. And if you're going to let guys like Jose Altuve and Alex Bregman
get away with it
and all these guys continue to play and hold their records, they better not be eligible for the Hall of Fame. I mean, I hate to say it because I love these guys, but they better not be eligible. All I know is if I am a Los Angeles Dodger fan, I'm getting ready to drive to MLB headquarters and burn them down right now because the Dodgers, and this is crazy for me to say, got the rawest deal, I would argue, in the history of baseball. They had to run into that buzzsaw multiple years.
Yeah. Do you mean that trash can?
Yeah. Buzzsaw, trash can, same thing. I think our biggest takeaway, however, my friend, is thank goodness for the Washington Nationals, who potentially saved baseball.
Shout out to third string listener, DFOP, dear friend of the pod, Josh Goldman, Washington Nationals fan.
Yeah. Thank goodness that the Nats saved baseball. Can you imagine if we had Trash Can Gate affect three straight World Series? Mm. I mean, two is bad enough.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, it's awful. We're pretty short on time here, Pete. We should move on. But I do want to mention real quick, you alluded to this. Reports out, it's not well sourced. It looked like it originated from an Instagram comment. But at least one person who seems like he maybe might have some well-placed sources is saying Mike Trout has been on HGH for a little-known thyroid condition.
For years.
Off the top of your head, do you think this is true? And actually, while I ask you that, I'm going to pull up Twitter and see if anything else has transpired on this topic since we started this, because this was a late breaking story that had come out just a couple hours before we hopped on here.
So here's what I will say. Based on the way that we've seen Mike Trout handle so much of being in Anaheim, watching the way he's played the game, he's not only a fantastic hitter, he's a fantastic outfielder. I really don't think it was Mike Trout finding a loophole, like this Instagram post is alleging that he found a loophole that he could take HGH. But I will say that I am nervous that somewhere this is probably rooted in fact that he has been taking things at some point in his career that were not totally legal, that based on the poor way that Major League Baseball for the last decade and a half has evaluated drug testing, they've beefed it up here in the last two or three years, but how they were doing this in the early 2010s and mid part of the decade, I wouldn't be surprised if Mike Trout had experimented with some things, probably rehabbing from an injury that now are illegal. What's one of the interesting things that Instagram post, which I think is probably 100% accurate, if true, backing up the HGH allegation, is that Major League Baseball doesn't know what to do with this because they can't go after one of their biggest stars. We've talked for years about why does he stay in Anaheim? Yeah, he's got a lot of money there, but he's a Philly guy. Maybe Anaheim, which is a organization we've learned in the past 6 months, has a drug problem internally. Maybe Anaheim has figured out a way to help cover this up, and maybe this is a much bigger conspiracy at this point. I mean, this could be the most disastrous offseason in the history of baseball. If we're going to attack Mike Trout, if we're going to fire three managers, if we're going to take away World Series titles, if we're going to remove hardware, if we're going to go after records holders, this could be really, really bad.
I think you're right. By the way, the person who made that allegation is Scott Brosius' son, David Brosius. A couple of tweets to read to you here that you might enjoy, Pete. One person says, oh, hell yeah, turn this up. Started with trash cans and now we've reached, quote, Mike Trout takes HGH for a thyroid loophole. And then here's another one. It says Mike Trout is obviously on HGH, human goat hormone. So
that's a good one.
The short of it is that there is no more enlightening material on Twitter about this story. So stay tuned. Maybe we'll have more to talk about next week. Okay, Pete, we need to move on and wrap this up. it's time for our pick 'em segment where we're going to talk about NFL playoffs. Fortunately for us and the time that we have remaining, we only have two games to talk about this week.
Can we talk about our records from last week real quick before we get into this? Yeah. Just asking for a friend. How'd you do last week?
I went 3-1 on money line and 1-3 against the spread. How about you?
I believe we picked against the spread, though, didn't we?
We did. Well, we gave both. We predicted who would win, and then we went against the spread as well. So, so my picks against the spread, I picked Vikings +7. They got crushed by San Francisco. That did not go well.
Yep.
And I picked what I thought was a pretty good lock, and that was Ravens -9. And boy, did I look stupid for making
Saturday
that pick.
Is not a great day for you.
And then I went, I thought this was actually a pretty safe bet. I went Texans +9.5. And when the Texans were winning 24-0,
you were feeling good. I was feeling
halfway
bad.
Through
you
the second quarter, I was like, booyah, let's roll. And then Pat Mahomes just turned it on. And then I picked Packers -4, and that is the one that I got right against the spread. So it was a weird betting weekend, man. It was not great. However, I did go 3-1 on money lines because I picked Niners, Ravens, Chiefs, Packers. So lost the Ravens one. How about you? How'd you do?
I went 3-1 in both categories as well, where I did much better against the spread. I got a little lucky. But at the same time, not bad considering how badly I did during wildcard weekend. So.
You are clearly the superior better between us.
Clearly, I have finally found my skill. It's a good thing I live in Vegas where I can lose all of my money very quickly.
Well, let's go against the spread here again. I think the money line this week is not nearly as interesting because there are such heavy favorites. The Chiefs and the 49ers are very heavy favorites to win. Both of them are -330. So for unschooled listeners in the way of sports gambling and betting lines, -330 odds mean that if you were to bet on the Chiefs to win, you would need to bet $330 in order to win $100. So that means very heavy favorites essentially. Now the Titans, for example, are +265, and how to read that is if you bet $100, you would win $265. So pretty heavy underdogs. And the lines I'm looking at right now are actually identical. So Chiefs and Niners, both -330 favorites. Packers and Titans, both +265. So let's go with the spread, though, Pete. I mean, the money line, we could have some interesting discussion about an upset and all that, and we should do that. But the spread is just a little more interesting. So the spread I have for both games, based on what I'm looking at right now, is actually also identical. Chiefs -7.5, Niners -7.5. Let's take the AFC first. Titans or Chiefs? Chiefs -7.5.
First of all, I don't think you can ever bet against the Chiefs and ever feel good about it. Just on the money line, of course, I'm going with the Chiefs on this one. Where I think this is going to be interesting is just like we've talked about the last 2 weeks, I am riding high on the Derrick Henry train. I think he's going to be a little tired. I think the Chiefs defense is unique in what he's going to face. But where the Chiefs have really struggled, and they are 29th in the NFL right now, is in run defense. So if you look at the way Derrick Henry's been running and just his grinded out style, I think if the Chiefs allow the Titans to control the tempo, specifically with Derrick Henry, it's going to be a tighter game. I don't think Ryan Tannehill has the arm to keep up in the passing game. So I still absolutely give the Chiefs the advantage for so many reasons, most of which is Pat Mahomes. But I think the Titans can absolutely make this a closer game than what we saw the Texans were able to pull off this past week. I really like Derrick Henry in this matchup, and I think he's going to keep this one a little closer than the experts predict.
Yeah, I think that is right. So are you going with Chiefs or Titans? On the
Chiefs outright, but I'm taking the Titans on the spread.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, I'm doing the same thing exactly. I think your run defense point is spot on. It also, you know, the Mike Vrabel defense has been really good at pressuring opposing quarterbacks and getting to them quickly. They threw Lamar Jackson off his rhythm. Obviously, they shut Brady down. I mean, over the past two playoff games against playoff offenses, they've allowed what did the Patriots score? 13 points?
Yes.
So they've allowed 25 points total in two games. And now one of those was against a pretty anemic offense in the Patriots, but they held the Ravens to 12 points.
Yeah. And Lamar Jackson just looked out of sorts all night, which he hasn't looked like that all year.
Totally out of sorts. Yeah. And so, the Titans have proven that they can keep a game close, right? And shut down a prolific offense. And I think what you'll see them do is, one, try to run a lot, run Derrick Henry. Two, probably dig into the purse and pull out some trick plays, at least one trick play. I think we'll see a special teams, you know, a little bit of trickery, maybe a fake punt here or a little, Statue of Liberty or something fun. And three, I think they'll be good at getting to Mahomes early and often, which does two things. One, throws him off, you know, forces errors like interceptions, fumbles, strip sacks, turnovers, whatever. But also limits the downfield stuff, right? Because if you give the downfield options less time to develop, it's they're not going to be there as often. So limiting, you know, Tyreek Hill and Mecole Hardman on big chunk plays is going to be important. So I also think that Tennessee will hold it close.
I think what's going to be funny in this game is you think back to the last game the Chiefs played, where obviously they were down 24 points and stormed back in the same quarter. Has anyone had more dynamic performances in the playoffs? I would argue in the last 5 years than what we saw out of Mahomes in that game and what we've seen out of Derrick Henry in the first two games the Titans have played. It's just like both of these guys have just been lights out. I think it's, and I hope it's going to be a lot of fun because these dudes, they've been setting it on fire so far. And I'm excited for that matchup, even though they don't actually play against each other. I'm excited for Pat Mahomes and Derrick Henry to do something.
I agree. Okay, let's go to NFC Championship Green Bay Packers at San Francisco 49ers. Niners -7.5. Who do you have here?
I like the Packers to cover. I do in that. The Packers really surprised me against the Seahawks. We talked a little bit about them being disrespected. We talked about Aaron Rodgers has lost a step. It seemed like everyone really stuck to the script and were executing that. And the Seahawks just couldn't get close enough inside that execution to really muddle it. I think the Packers defense continues to be suspect. You look at the way that the Seahawks came back in that game and made it close. Russell Wilson, never a normal game.
Never.
But at the same time, I was really impressed with the Packers game planning. So I like them to keep this closer. You know, we are in the NFC Championship, and I still don't know what I'm getting out of the 49ers. Jimmy Garoppolo, I am still a big fan of. I think he's one of the more underappreciated quarterbacks in the sport. Kyle Shanahan has demonstrated that he can offensively game plan with the best of them. Richard Sherman in that secondary has been pretty good. I would argue Richard Sherman is the second best cornerback on that team. So that's been interesting, but the 49ers are just a great unknown to me still, to be completely honest.
Yeah, that's fair. Lots of unknown. I mean, it's a young team with a relatively new head coach still kind of trying to find its identity and figure it out. So I agree with you. I do think, though, that on this one, I'm going to go with Niners -7.5. The last time these two teams met, week 12 of the NFL, November 24th, the Niners won 37-8.
Yeah, not a great game.
Now, I mean, I get it. You know, it's only week 12. Playoff games are different. All of that stuff, yada, yada, yada. I don't discount Aaron Rodgers. We did talk just a couple weeks ago about how I no longer think he's a great quarterback. I think he's a, you know, average to good quarterback. But he has experience, right? He has a Super Bowl under his belt. Yeah. Garoppolo does not. I do think this will not be a repeat of 37-8, but I think that the Niners will win this one by a pretty comfortable margin. It'll be probably a two-score game. I think something like, you know, 34-24 is a reasonable thing to expect. So I'm going to go with the Niners on this. But I agree with you. The Niners are still kind of searching for their identity, but they have been able to score points. Shanahan, I think, is one of the best offensive designers in the league. He's been very successful in that. I don't think Garoppolo is a great quarterback, but I think Shanahan is really good at scheming to his strengths. And so this is not going to be like a huge quarterback showdown, but I think this will be a Aaron Rodgers, Kyle Shanahan showdown. But I'm going to go with a more talented, more complete roster on the whole, the Niners at -7.5. So I'm going Niners money line, of course, and the -7.5.
Fair enough. Our last weekend with multiple football games, and then we'll take a break before the big one. Hopefully it's a better Super Bowl than what we saw last year.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, no kidding. All right, Pete, we will end it there. We are over our allotted quota anyway. Thanks so much for joining me for another discussion, though, of all this stuff. I'm glad we could finally record it, but I'm also glad that we waited so we could talk about Mike Trout on the human goat hormone.
I know. I can't wait to see what tomorrow brings in this beautiful disaster that is the baseball offseason.
It's pretty bad, man. It's pretty bad. Well, maybe they'll bring Pete Rose back.
I'm for it.
And as long as they get rid of the title, right? As long as they vacate exactly. The World Series win.
Take out the trophy. Give me Pete Rose back. I'm happy.
Now, let me just throw a little hypothetical real quick at you. If it comes out that Anthony Rendon was on PEDs and Davey Martinez knew about it, do you vacate the Nats title?
No, because we've demonstrated that PEDs are not nearly as serious as banging on a trash can. Your point is null and void.
All right, fair enough.
Any place for the Angels now. If anything, you just made my bigger point that there is a conspiracy in the Angels organization.
That's a good point. Yeah, I didn't
think about it. That's why they brought him. That's why he signed with them.
Didn't think about the Angels trade.
It was an inside job, man.
He knew it was where he could get HGH for his thyroid problem. It's like getting marijuana for your glaucoma, right?
Exactly. People are lining up.
All right, man. To our listeners, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Third String Podcast. You can get in touch with us. Let us know what we missed, what we could do better, what we should talk about next time. Third String, 3RD String at vernacularpodcast.com. Until then, I'm Zach.
And I'm Pete.
Have a great week.